Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Teleport by Joshua T. Calvert. Narrated by Eric Altheide. Prologue. The drillship looked like a gray, salt-eaten garbage dump. 255 meters long and 42 meters wide, it was an ugly colossus formed of steel, dirt, and the monetary dreams of wealthy executives on another continent, who wanted nothing to do with the dirty work that made them so much money. There was so much metal protruding from its hull, it resembled a dense forest. It made your eyes blur as it dominated all but the actual drilling rig, a 100-meter tower of spindly struts, atop which sprouted two yellow-painted fingers containing numerous probes and the arm-thick bolts of the rig's safety system. The Deep Sea Explorer, as it was called, trudged leisurely through the mouth of Lake Maracaibo, accompanied by a fleet of smaller barges and supply ships. They passed the town that gave the lake its name, whose houses overgrew the left bank like spotty mushrooms. From the stern of the main ship leading the small fleet, Anders Larsen felt the passage through the strait was a rape of the place's natural beauty. The bluish-green water stood out against the long Major Rafael Urdaneta Bridge, a silver line connecting the two shores in the background. It had opened only a few hours ago, with great fanfare. The thousands of inhabitants of Maracaibo had come to witness the spectacle of their passing, not because the leisurely procession was particularly handsome. No, the people's dreams overrode its lack of beauty. The deep-sea explorer meant prosperity for the whole region. At least, that was what the Venezuelan government had been trying to assure them for months. But that was not why Anders was here. He had come to oversee the drilling effort and ensure that schedules were met, not deal with the political lies that had guaranteed his employer was contracted. In truth, it was not his usual employer at all, but an art enterprise, a diplomatic Frankenstein. A year ago, prospectors from Shell had discovered a new oil reservoir under the lake, which was already a rich source of black gold. The first samples were taken by engineers from Russia's Bashneft. No doubt it was due to the close ties between the Russian and Venezuelan governments that this incident, as the EU Commission president had called it, had occurred. Eventually, an agreement that all sides could live with had been reached, unhappily, but greedily. A European-Russian company was formed to exploit the new oil source. That the data was hardly clear enough to be so contentious in advance of drilling had apparently interested no one. Anders, however, knew that the huge cavity under the seabed, because the lake was not actually a lake at all, but an inlet of the Gulf of Venezuela, could also be a bubble of compacted gas. Not an ideal proposition.
"Why are you making such a face?"
Alexei Yevchenkov asked. Yevchenkov, the Russian chief engineer, stood next to him, his elbows on the railing. He eyed the ugly pile of ships marked by the dirt of their work, lit a cigarette, and inhaled with a hiss. "Smoking is a bad habit, but for someone who works in the petroleum sector, it's particularly suicidal." Yevchenkov waved it off.
"Ah, I don't see any oil yet. And I have reason to celebrate."
"Like what?" Anders raised a brow.
"It's warm."
The Russian put the cigarette between his lips and spread his arms.
"Tropical temperatures. Fresh sea air. A new project with good pay. What more could you want?"
"To confirm what we think we found?"
"Don't be so doom and gloom. My compatriots found the black broth, so it's there."
"The entire lake bottom is full of oil, but a reservoir like what we think we found sounds almost too good, if you ask me," Anders replied glumly.
"Think positive. The fleet is here. Tomorrow night we can start drilling the first well."
Yevchenkov's rolling accent somehow matched the rugged appearance of the ships leisurely pursuing them.
"Then we will stand here and watch our contracts turn to gold."
Anders shook his head. "No, we're not going to stand here."
"I don't know what you're going to do, but I don't have anything to do until the day after tomorrow."
He interrupted his Russian colleague. "Did you read anything about this place before you got on the plane?"
"Yes, the weather data, and how high the Andes are that frame the lake."
Anders stifled a frustrated sigh.
"Oh, come on," Yevchenkov rolled his eyes. "All right, then. Why won't we stand here?"
Because this place has the most lightning per square kilometer in the world. There are violent thunderstorms just about every night. The lake is a warm 30 degrees Celsius. The high foothills of the Andes, which you like so much, hold the moisture that evaporates during the day in the geological basin. At night, the slopes of the mountains cool much faster than the warm air above the lake. Now, at the height of summer, up to 100 lightning bolts per square kilometer have been recorded. Per night. 5 oil production facilities catch fire or are destroyed every year. Shoreline deaths occur weekly, and the discharges kill entire herds of livestock. Anders nodded as he saw his colleague grow pale. So, the high salary that you're so happy about has the proverbial catch. They remained silent until they arrived at their destination 10 hours later. Anders ate in the small mess hall, reviewed final checks and reports from his staff, and signed off on the plan for the initial drilling. The Inland Sea was only 35 meters deep at its deepest point, making a drill ship like the Deep Sea Explorer, which could drill to 14,000 meters, overkill. Still, this was not his easiest project. The presumed proven oil reservoir was over 9,000 meters deep. The bottom was riddled with tiny veins of seawater, perfect conductors for the electrical discharges that boiled over the lake every night. On top of that, there was the danger of not being able to drill a direct channel. Instead, they'd have to fight fractures in the sediment over and over again. Apart from that, he could already envision a disaster similar to BP's in the Gulf of Mexico, approaching after the first lightning cascade set fire to an improperly sealed pipeline. At 11 p.m. local time, he was standing on the bridge of the Dolphin, the only reasonably comfortable ship in their sweatshop fleet that housed management, and thus he and Yevchenkov as project managers. Together, they stood on the bridge and watched the deep-sea explorer, now just a conglomerate of lights in the darkness, surrounded by the nearby escort ships, holding their positions like smaller outgrowths. From a kilometer away, the Colossus in their midst almost looked like a still image, creating many reflections on the rippled surface of the lake when not moving restlessly back and forth. "Que tre disgrazia," said one of the Venezuelan engineers near the captain, who was disinterestedly sipping a coffee.
"What's he saying?"
Anders wanted to know.
"Something about bad luck," Yevchenkov replied, shrugging. "But don't worry. They're all superstitious here."
"Because of the lightning, I suppose."
"Yes. Read a guidebook. Locals think the center of the lake is cursed, partly because of the lightning. Supposedly, a lot of fishermen have disappeared here."
"Disappeared?"
"Sunk. I don't know."
The Russian shrugged again. "Well then," Anders put his radio to his mouth. "All right, get started. Constant pressure checks. I don't want the valves loaded above 90%. Got it?" He received confirmation from his chief engineer aboard the drillship and hummed with satisfaction. Red lights started rotating above the rig, a sign the project had finally begun. The predicted thunderstorm arrived half an hour later, announcing itself with a deep rumble of thunder that rolled in from the mouth of the Inland Sea. Half an hour after that, Anders was one of the few still awake and following the events on the Deep Sea Explorer by binocular and radio. The storm reached them and enveloped the entire fleet with dense rain, bone-shaking thunder, and so many flashes of lightning that he had to keep blinking to get rid of the flickering afterimages. At times, the entire horizon lit up, and he thought he saw dozens of discharges at once, forming jagged blurs between the masses of smothering clouds and the whipped-up sea. It was an eerie sight that made the hairs on the back of his neck stand on end. "Just a thunderstorm," he thought. He urged himself to be calm. But the next flashes of lightning struck the surface of the water next to the drillship, causing white spray to leap up in several places at once. In their light, the ships looked bizarre, like nightmarish shadows of angular metal and sharp blades. And if these impacts had frightened him, it soon got worse. Second by second, more massive electrical pulses crashed into the water. They seemed to move concentrically toward the deep-sea explorer. Anders spotted irregularities in the dancing waves and jerked back from his binoculars. He was startled when he realized they were merely dead fish. Over his radio, he intercepted the first panicked calls from security technicians on the drillship, their initial worried queries now manifesting. Someone was taken to the infirmary. It was hard to make out because so many employees were calling in the confusion, some in different languages. "Meyer, come in," he yelled angrily on his safety engineer's channel. Lawson, all hell is breaking loose here. We've had two impacts. They didn't do any structural damage, but several workers got burned, and the Venezuelans are totally freaking out. They want to evacuate. His German co-worker's voice was scratchy with static. Have they gone crazy? Threaten immediate dismissal. I don't care. They're just flashes. I'm trying to do that. But, Meyer, what's wrong? We've got something weird on the ground sensors here. There's a lot of energy building up. In what form? Electricity. Down there? Yeah. Also, the drill head has registered some magnetic anomaly. It's pulling almost 5 degrees to the left. Impossible! Lawson, I'm telling you, this is... The connection broke. Anders kept hitting the send button and yelling into the microphone, but got no response. He looked up through the bridge windows. At first, there was just a feeling that something was happening, though he didn't see any change. Then the lights on the deep-sea explorer shook and danced. The steel colossus shook as if it were standing on a vibrating plate. Suddenly, something happened that he saw with his eyes, but his brain could not make sense of. The ship was squeezed like a soda can. The hull wrinkled and cracked, compressed until it was the size of a semi-truck, and buffeted by the inland sea tides rushing in. The escorted fleet was moved, pulled downward several meters and toward the flotilla's destroyed center, as if invisible hands were tugging at them from the depths. "What's happening?" Larson shouted, not expecting an answer. The entire Dolphin bridge crew froze until the captain started yelling wild orders in Italian. The horizon of destruction before Anders slowly veered away as their ship was pulled to port and the engines engaged with a loud roar. "Where is my ship?" The compressed mountain of sheet metal left a mighty whirlpool as it sank into the water, whipped up by the concentrated lightning striking exactly where a ship, over 250 meters long, had been moments ago. The night seemed especially dark, and the thunder deafening, as the deep-sea explorer disappeared and the fleet fled hopelessly. Anders breathed heavily. His heart was pounding like a steam hammer in his chest, and cold sweat stood on his forehead.
"Mr. Lawson." The voice was slurred, and he hurriedly looked around.
He was lying in his bunk on the Dolphin, looking into the boxy face of an unshaven man, Yevchenkov.
"They're here."
I'll be right there," he said to his colleague. He struggled out of the wet sheets and stepped into the shower, letting the rain of tingling drops run down his face. The images of the dream slowly rolled off him like stubborn dirt. The last week had been pure hell. Not only had all the local employees and suppliers pulled out, but many of the European and Russian employees refused to fulfill their contracts. Not that Anders had any idea about how they would do that anyway. Experts from the Russian and European conglomerate had flown in, but never arrived at the lake. There were special diplomatic envoys with their respective EU and Kremlin advisory staffs, and displayed such a strangely cool manner that they could only be intelligence officers. They had questioned him, Yevchenkov, and the bridge crew for days, before the first warships had arrived. First, the USS Brixton, a Navy cruiser, then the Russians Kuznetsov, until six ships from each of the two nations reached the center of the lake 3 days ago. They were assured it was merely a joint maneuver, following an invitation from the Venezuelan president, as if the U.S. and Russia would ever conduct combined operations. Since then, the water shook continuously, and the number of dead fish on the surface had increased. Anders dried off, got dressed, and picked up his luggage, which he had packed the night before and placed next to the door. On the quarterdeck, the helicopter that would take them to the international airport was already warmed up. Yevchenkov and the captain of the Dolphin were already sitting in the passenger cabin and wearing their thick headphones to protect their ears from the noise. Anders began to sweat again, despite the gale-force winds. He ducked under the rotors to join them. On his seat was a folder held closed with a rubber band. He picked it up before he sat down and pushed his suitcase under the seat with his heels.
"It's a cease and desist," Yevchenko said over the radio.
"A cease and desist letter? For what?" Anders asked as he fumbled the mouthpiece to his lips and clumsily removed the rubber band. 200 pages?
"Yes. Your people and my people obviously don't want us to talk about this crazy thing."
"But 200 pages? The helicopter took off as if in slow motion, wobbling slightly.
They predated the military exercise by a week. Supposedly, there was an accident with a nuclear submarine under our drilling fleet. Some sort of secret maneuver that caused the rig to blow up, the Russian explained, then pursed his lips.
Such a... Anders waved it off. It doesn't matter. With 200 pages, I'm sure they've covered everything even remotely related to Venezuela to silence us in court.
And break us financially, Yevchenkov added.
The helicopter banked in a long arc, past the tightly clumped fleet of American and Russian warships arrayed in an almost perfect circle. Two supply ships, thick hulks of gray steel, were in their midst. From their decks, huge cranes supported steel cables that descended into the blue waves. The cruisers and destroyers in the vicinity began to darken the sky with smoke launchers, obscuring the sight from prying eyes in orbit or aircraft skirting the no-fly zone. Anders managed to catch a glimpse of an oval shadow being lifted from the depths by the cranes. At first, he thought of a giant whale, but the shape was too uniform, too perfect, even if the edges were anything but clear and blurred by the water effects.
What is that?
He whispered, not needing to ask to know this mysterious shadow was located exactly where the deep-sea explorer had sunk a week ago.
That must be the wreck, opined Yevchenkov, leaning over the armrest of his seat,
but the smoke was already so thick their view remained locked out.
That was not the wreck, Anders thought.
Chapter 1. James pretended to read the mission briefing, but held the documents in front of him so he could hide his smartphone from the two State Department officers. The flight from Washington to Mombasa took forever, but sleep was out of the question. He was far too nervous for that. This mission was too delicate to even take a quiet minute. So he bred little pixel chickens, planted new fields, and laid tiny streams to nurture his digital farm. The game was a useful distraction, not because he was worried about blowing the assignment, but because of the special conditions it entailed. He had waited for this opportunity for 3 years, and the time had finally come. The right assignment at the right time. Now he eagerly waited for a text. He'd been checking for a total of 20 hours and 31 minutes, and for good measure, his email too. Nothing. No answer. Mr. Hamilton? He looked up at one of the two flight attendants dressed in blue and white uniforms, providing service on the small Learjet. Her smile was flawless as she offered him a perfectly folded hot cloth on a tray. Thank you. He carefully picked it up and wiped his hands, and when no one was looking, his face as well. The Foreign Service officers, Carl Vega and Mitch Blake, were two feisty Washington civil servants with big bellies and thinning hair. They shifted in their seats and woke out of the half-sleep that had befuddled them for the past few hours and allowed James to get some rest. Vega cleared his throat noisily and said in a groggy voice,
"Good morning."
"Good morning," James replied.
"We landing soon?"
"They're about to serve breakfast. Maybe an hour."
"Didn't you sleep at all?"
Vega rubbed his eyes and smoothed his shirt.
"No need." "This thing is really important, Mr. Hamilton.
Vincent DeBongo is a key informant for the CIA, and I really need to interrogate him to know what he might have revealed.
I get it.
Besides, his father is an extremely wealthy industrialist in Kenya." James tapped the folder and flipped it shut, letting the smartphone fall into his lap as he did so, concealed by the table. "I went through everything." In truth, he hadn't read a single line of the CIA report. Certain there was nothing unexpected there.
"Good. Then you also know that
Vincent DeBongo is an undercover agent with Boko Haram. Your eyes and ears in one of the worst terrorist organizations in the world." Those were the Secretary of State's words, weren't they?
"Exactly."
Vega raised his hands in surrender.
"All right.
You have to trust me. I'm the best at my job."
"That's what we've been told,"
Vega responded, nodding and smiling as he got his own hot towel. The jet touched down at Moy International Airport at 9 a.m. local time and slowly taxied to the small private terminal where a host of intelligence officers checked their IDs and special documents and bombarded them with a huge arsenal of stamps before loading them into a large Volkswagen SUV with tinted windows, one of three vehicles waiting for them. The soldiers accompanying them wore baggy uniforms and held Kalashnikovs with scuffed wooden elements.
James had been to Africa enough times to know these guys were tough and probably better trained than they looked. Their small convoy raced over the dusty streets of the smoggy city, breaking all traffic rules and not caring about red lights. More than once, James thought they were going to crash and was happy he had buckled up. Blake, the other officer, was turning white and looked as if he wanted to throw up. It got better once they left the city and were traveling west over endless dirt roads. He had never been to Kenya before, which had disappointed him the last 3 years, and he had imagined it differently. The land near the great deltas and inland seas surrounding this juggernaut of a city was surprisingly green and well-watered. There were banana plantations and cassava fields as far as the eye could see. The sun blazed down on them. It was so hot that he felt it through the roof of the SUV, although the air conditioning was running at full blast. It was probably just his imagination. Still, he was sweating where his back and buttocks touched the faux leather of the back seat. Each kilometer they traveled west, the landscape became drier and more barren. Green fields were replaced by brown ones. Old farm machinery no longer functioned, so instead, hundreds of men and women with cloths on their heads rammed simple tools into the earth to plow or harvest the meager crops. Leaves were replaced by withered branches and grasses, and eventually by light sand. Their motorcade, speeding madly, kicked up huge clouds of dust behind them, which looked like a storm front in the rearview mirror, shifting northward in the light southerly wind, enveloping the field workers and settling on their few crops. It was like looking at a real-life metaphor, showing him how the world worked. Some drove through the countryside in luxurious cars, their soft bodies wafted by the cool of an air conditioner, while others tried to wrest food from the earth by the simplest of means, and were smothered by the dirt of others in the process. The world in one sentence, he thought, and chewed on his lower lip as the shadowy figures in the dust slowly became recognizable again. I wonder if they are even bothered by it anymore. Or do they just keep working and take it?
Are you all right?
Vega asked, worried. His shirt was already sweated through, where it was stretched across the rolls of flab.
You look restless.
Don't worry. The deal will work out.
What makes you so sure?
James shrugged. I have experience, and your boss requested the best, right? Blake turned around in the passenger seat and looked like he was about to say something, but James just raised a hand. Look, both of you. It just occurred to me how strange it is to be here.
What do you mean?
Vega frowned. The CIA is making a deal with Kenyan Intelligence, whose acronym I don't even know. These people here, he pointed out the window, even though there were no more fields to be seen, work their whole lives to make a dollar a day. They have calluses on their hands, aching backs, and one of their 5 children will starve to death next year. How much money do we have available? Huh?
About $20 million,
Vega replied, not understanding it was a rhetorical question. I wonder what you could do with that money, instead of playing a game that has only created chaos for 100 years.
You mean we should give the money to the people, so they can have more food? Only to have Boko Haram slaughter them a few months from now.
Come on. You don't believe that, do you? The CIA just wants to get their hands on your information to protect our people. If it hadn't been for the attack on our embassy in Mombasa, we wouldn't have lifted a finger. How long do you think it would take to eliminate these terrorists if we really wanted to?
It's not our place to judge,
Blake grumbled, turning around.
You're here because you know Vincent Dibango personally.
I don't need a motivational speech. And I only spoke to him for 15 minutes 2 months ago at an embassy reception in Cape Town, where he was a guest with his father. That's hardly a special connection.
The agency needs you to be as motivated as possible to do your best. And so does the ministry. We don't need to worry about anything else.
Of course we don't. So, let's get our rich son out of there and make the world a better place. James snorted and looked out the window, ending the conversation. By now, there was little to interest the eye, except various shades of brown in the mountains, which looked like they were covered in rust. They were rugged and jagged, while possessing a raw beauty that radiated something untouched, authentic, just like this entire continent, which he was never sure whether to love or hate. He had enough reasons to do both wholeheartedly. That much was certain. Rakonga, their destination and agreed meeting place, was, Wikipedia assured him, a village. But the CIA's brief had been much more realistic. There were perhaps a dozen huts, with corrugated iron roofs and rough wooden walls that appeared to date back to colonial times. There were never more than two huts in one place, and the few gnarled trees barely concealed the neighboring houses, which were a few hundred meters away. Their convoy stopped in front of a particularly long one-story building with Moy High School Kasigao written above the entrance, then stopped with a screech of tires. It took a minute for the cloud of dust to catch up with them and pass. Then their driver turned to him. "We're here," he said. He had a strong accent and a serious face. "All right, then. I guess it's my turn now," James said, nodding. He prepared to get out.
"Wait a minute. What about your bag?"
Vega asked, pointing to the small briefcase in the footwell. "Is this his first time?" James asked Blake. He shook his head, exited. He slammed the door behind him, and silence fell until a hot wind blew withered baobab leaves around his feet. The school was surrounded by rust-brown dust clouds, formed by tiny breezes, and appeared abandoned. But he knew better. He walked along the short gravel path to the front door, avoiding the urge to look around for his escort. He recognized the need, that basic instinct, wanting to call his tribe for support, help, or even simple closeness. But the task at hand had to work without all that. That was his job. He knocked on the dry wood. He felt its rough grain against his knuckles. A Kenyan man in a forest camouflage uniform opened the door and pressed the muzzle of a pistol against his forehead. The metal was cold, making it feel absurdly comfortable. "I am unarmed," he said, and swallowed. The knowledge that death was, as of now, a potential outcome for the day hit him in his core and electrified him from the soles of his feet to the tips of his hair. There was no more room for sorrow or worry, only breathing, arrow-quick thoughts, and the assimilation of every smell, no matter how tiny. Every one of his senses resonated and was focused, as if someone had turned an intensity knob past maximum.
"Step forward, Tumba,"
the man hissed, dragging him inside by his shoulder before scowling at the SUVs and slamming the door shut. They stood in a dimly lit room, a huge classroom, the only one in the supposed high school. Four more gunmen stood or sat around two desks, their rifles shouldered. The whites of their eyes shone in their ebony faces, like predators at dusk. James was roughly searched for weapons, but he had nothing on him except his smartphone. One of the terrorists took it and removed the battery before putting both in his pocket. He then pulled a black burlap sack out of his backpack and put it over James's head. The world abruptly went black, and he nearly tripped as he was grabbed roughly from behind and shoved forward. Someone pushed something pointed into his back that his imagination and experience made into the muzzle of a Kalashnikov. The bag smelled of a mixture of dust and sweat and a hint of cinnamon that confused him. Door hinges squeaked, barely audible, but the unpleasant sound did not escape James's brain, which was running in overdrive, nor did the wind blowing across the loose piece of varnish on the door through which he was pushed. He was put into a car that smelled of leather, faded by the sun. The air became suddenly stuffy as soon as the doors were closed. The engine howled. He felt no fear, at least no more than he was used to in situations like this. He was experienced enough to know how this worked, and there was nothing unusual happening yet. Since he would be nothing but trouble for them anyway, he could relax. And he did, in his own way. He enjoyed the heightened senses, the metallic taste in his mouth, as if he had taken too many painkillers. Nothing mattered more than the sounds around him, the feel of the seat under his buttocks and against his back, of being carried and not having to do anything. Freed from monotonous thoughts about unimportant things that had nothing to do with real life, he relished the here and now, inhaling and exhaling, perceiving one moment and the next, and all at the same time. Simple and intuitive, his body took care of all that automatically. It needed no intervention, just his presence. The drive lasted about 2 or 3 hours, although it was impossible to estimate, since it seemed to him like an eternity. But at the same
sample complete. Ready to continue?